Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Richard Steinzig. Why don't you join us as we discuss that at times almost incomprehensible age, adolescence. We'll try to help you put a little fact to that time and learn how to deal with this period of your children's life. You can reach us with your questions and comments in Anchorage. Our number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free address, telephone number is 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is new, line1, as usual. I'll spell it out, at alaskapublic.org. Richard, it's a pleasure to have you join us.
It's good to be here.
I became aware of you and asked you to come because you sent around a list of parent. You call it the top 10 parenting traps. You want to tell us a little bit about that? You sent it to, I don't know, at least to pediatricians because I got one, and I thought it was good enough and well enough done and an important enough topic to get you on the air.
Well, I sent it off because when I have families come into my office, there's seems to be a common theme oftentimes when parents are talking about their families and talking about their kids and how they are trying to intervene and some of their ways that they're intervening, talking to their kids is not particularly helpful. And sometimes it becomes a little bit more counterproductive. So I kind of threw out a little quick list to kind of help us kind of talk about, and I use this with my families in my office, just some things that we're doing and different things that we can do that can be more helpful to keep the dialogue going.
My plan today is to talk a little bit, just as an introductory component to the program, about adolescence in parents and what the purpose of parenting is and what adolescence is all about, what we know about it. And then we're going to go through his list, as many of these as we can, and talk about them. Anyone who would like to, you can go to our website and look at the list. We may not get through all of them. And there are some links to other places where you can get more detailed information about parenting adolescents in particular. But before we do that, Richard, tell me and our listeners just a little bit about licensed clinical social workers. I want to put that, I don't know that I've specifically interviewed a social worker. I must have had a couple on the air, but I don't know that we've ever talked about that degree and how it's used.
Well, a licensed clinical social worker is a social worker that has a master's degree in social work, MSW. And to become licensed in the state of Alaska, you need 3,000 hours postgraduate experience, which is 2 to 3 years, and then you need at least 100 hours of supervision with a registered or appropriate supervisor, and you have to take a licensing test.
Mm-hmm. And then you're doing counseling, and some you may specialize in just families or certain areas of adulthood or issues.
Well, I think a licensed clinical social worker, we work with families, teenagers, adults, substance abuse, and really the whole spectrum of the human services.
Okay. All right. Since we're talking about adolescence and a lot to do with parenting, how would you describe the role of a parent? What's the purpose of a parent to begin with?
Well, I think that we have to define the purpose of a parent of a young child, mm-hmm. and then the purpose of an parent of an adolescent. Certainly the purpose of a young child is to help provide some structure and safety and help them learn these skills that they're going to need growing up. Becoming a parent of an adolescent is oftentimes about providing some safety, some security, some limits, but also some encouragement to be able to move on, because the goal is to be able to, for the child, for the teenager, to become independent, be self-sufficient, and that the parents need to help their kids get to that point.
And from a and that makes all the sense in the world. I understand and I believe that. In fact, I should say our first logo when I went into practice was four nests in a row, one with a nest with an egg starting to crack, and then a nest with a young baby, and then the parent feeding the young bird, and then the last one was the bird flying away from the nest. So the purpose of that logo was to introduce the idea that that's the job of parents, is to let that develop, that child develop in their way, at the same time giving them the skills to be able to take off and deal with life in all its foils as well as it possibly can. But what's happening to adolescents? What are they doing, our children and adolescents, that leads to a better understanding, help us understand why there may be more conflict during the adolescence period?
Well, I think there's always been conflict in some adolescence period. But certainly the culture and the society right now, we are putting our teenagers into situations in which they're really not emotionally equipped to handle. The relationships that they're now being involved in, the expectations of school. I remember the things that we used to do, for example, in high school, kids are now doing in junior high. And the junior high down into elementary school. So things are coming down. I think we're expecting our teenagers to behave and act in a way that they're really not ready for. And I think that's where a lot of the conflict occurs.
Mm-hmm. I used the example before we came on the air to talk about it. In early childhood and toddlers, they're exploring their world. Everything revolves around them. They want everything they want when they want it, yet they're very dependent on their parents. In a sense, adolescence is the same situation in my mind. They want independence. They're striving to learn about themselves, make their own decisions. And yet I think of my role as a parent is still trying to help them realize, even though they think they know how things work, there's still a lot of stuff experience brings to you that we have got to try to share before we let them go. And even after we let them go, they're going to make some mistakes, and that making mistakes is not necessarily bad. It's another corollary of this whole thing. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Bad decisions make good judgments. Mm-hmm. hopefully, the bad decisions aren't too bad and too life-changing.
Right.
And that's tends to be the problem.
So kids can make some very, very bad decisions early on that is unfortunately regretful and may have lifelong consequences.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Another issue that we have not talked about that I like to talk about, and so I'm always, when I'm talking to psychologists and psychiatrists and social workers, I want to get their 10 cents worth, is this issue of temperament. And temperament to me is, okay, I got four daughters, same house, same mom, same dad, but they're different. Okay, we got the same genetics, and they're different from the get-go. One of them's more intense, one of them's more resistant to change, one of them's more regular, one of them can be calmed down early. I mean, so to me, even in medicine, that makes a difference. There are those kids who, when they're hurt, even though it may be minor, it is an earth-shattering consequence. And then the other sibling, same family, may be very badly hurt, but shakes it off, doesn't make much out of it. To me, that also has ramifications in the psychological world as well.
And I think that as a parent, we should know, or hopefully know, what our temperament of our individual children are, because mm-hmm. situations are different. Mm-hmm. If you have a teenager in your house that is, let's say, very shy, doesn't handle change very well, pretty reactive to stimuli, well, you're going to create some situations when you slowly expose them to some situations. You're not going to throw them in feet first. On the other hand, you could have a teenager in your house that is very self-assured and has a lot of confidence, and they can handle that kind of stimuli. So it's different for every kid, and I think the job of a parent is to try to understand how their kids are different, because when we start comparing and asking our kids to be just like their siblings, we start to run into a lot of problems because everybody's an individual.
Yeah, and the corollary of that is that it sounds as if we don't parent each child exactly the same way.
That's correct. It would be nice if we could, but
but I think there's almost sometimes this idea that we should parent each child the same.
Everybody's different.
Yeah.
Everybody's different.
All right, let me give our phone and email address again if you had questions or comments. Today we've just kind of begun to talk about adolescence and parenting in a general sense, and then we're going to move into some top 10 traps or perhaps mistakes we could think of that parents may do when talking or dealing with adolescents. But if you've got questions or comments, we'll try to work those into the conversation. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And perhaps one more point before we get into it, because someone has asked me to bring this up, is how do the new social media things, how are these things affecting adolescents? Is it, like you said earlier, we're bringing some important issues about life into a younger age group where they have to be a little bit more careful about what they're doing? Is that one of the lessons?
Yeah, and for better or for worse, I think the social media is here to stay. And then, you know, there are some benefits for Facebook or texting. You know, kids are able to develop and maintain relationships much differently than they could before. I think that there's some other problems and that the relationships have the potential of being more superficial. There's not much depth to them, and that can create problems later on. And I also think that the social media has the potential of missing out what it's like to actually sit with somebody and talk with someone and kind of see their reactions to things, because the typewritten word, it's a very superficial thing. Mm-hmm. And I think the danger is that we're losing the depth in relationships.
Mm-hmm. It's very hard to communicate by writing what you can say with personal interactions, because we lose it. One of the things of facial interactions and looking at each other's face, which we learn and interpret a lot from just watching each other's faces.
That is correct. And then there's the whole other issue about the written communication and how our kids are not writing as well as right. previous generations, because we're able to use these abbreviations and acronyms that as an adult I can barely keep up with.
It should be said that it looks like also not only teenagers and younger children are learning some of the consequences of the social media, but adults have also had to learn
this. Yes. Congressmen tend to make a little faux pas. Yes, bad judgment doesn't reside only in adolescence, that is for sure.
Yeah, which I guess brings up the point is that experience is what we're trying to get. And so anybody who's never had experience with social media is liable to make the same mistakes as a teenager.
And absolutely. It's the social media, there is such a immediate gratification. And I think that tends to... That helps for some people, and for others, it gets them in big trouble.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's try to get through these top 10 parenting traps as you describe them, and you're certainly welcome to talk about them in any way you want. I'm going to start with number 10 on your list. It says, comparing your teen to other family members or peers.
You know, when I was thinking about this one, it's oftentimes when a family will come into my office, they do the comparing. Well, you know, my daughter is not doing the same things that their older daughter did. And why doesn't their other child? Why is Johnny doing this? Brother never did those kind of things. And I think what happens is that we lose the sense of individuality. Everybody is different, Everybody looks at things differently, has a different perspective, and I think to try to lump everybody into everybody should be the same, I think is a disservice. And the teenagers basically let you know that they don't like being compared to others. It's pretty obvious. But the issues that come up, and certainly in my office and sessions, is I can't tell you how many times when a kid will say, don't compare me to. Mm-hmm. And they're absolutely right.
Is it fair for a parent when they start to do something, and maybe I'm jumping ahead here, to ask themselves how they would like to be felt if, for example, they were being compared with somebody else? You know, when a, let's say in a job situation, that an employer is telling an employee, well, you are not like the other. I mean, to me, I wouldn't like that necessarily either.
No, but it's like, what is the goal that we're talking about? Uh-huh. You know, is the expectation that one child should be an A student just like the other? The other student, the other child. Is it that child A never got into trouble and child B is always getting into trouble? I mean, you know, what are we talking about here? Mm-hmm. I think it's that the parents need to set up that dynamic of everybody is an individual. Because mm-hmm. nothing is – it's not – I think when we get into fairness issues, we really start going down a very rocky road.
And each child has a different set of strengths and weaknesses.
Absolutely.
One kid may be very good with social interactions. Another is not so secure in that. One may be much better in athletics. One's not. And that also gets to the issue of, I think about men when I try to do this, is all the men want their guys to be great basketball players or something, when it's, maybe that's not where that child's abilities even lie.
Absolutely. And when you try to push then mm-hmm. the kids into sports and they're not into sports, I mean, it doesn't create a happy situation. Mm-hmm. And this is where I think the parents need to look about what's – are they putting their own needs and their own wants onto that child, but things that they have missed out on their own childhood.
So if you shouldn't be comparing other families when you're talking with kids, what's an example of how they might want to approach using that kind of issue?
Well, I think you begin to say, tell me about what is it that you're interested in, you know, mm-hmm. and kind of recognizing that there are differences. And the difference mm-hmm. is, it's not a good or a bad, it just is. Mm-hmm. And so even though you do this, you know, A, B, and C, you know, we're going to deal with A, B, and C. We're not going to say this is how you should be based on some idealized image about what a older sibling did.
When you're making these comparison to other children, I'm envisioning it might happen at a time when you're upset about how one of your children did something, and so you might say, "Well, John wouldn't have done that." Would it be better to say, ask the other child, "Why did you do certain things?"
Well, I don't like the word "why."
Okay.
Because I don't think you get a real good answer with why. Mm-hmm. I often advise my parents not to use the word why, because there's really no good answer. Mm-hmm. You know, why did you...
Seems threatening from the first place.
Well, and what good answer is there? You know, you know, why did you throw the rock through the window?
Okay.
Well, what good answer could they really come up with? as opposed to...
I was experimenting with physics, Richard.
Sure. I wanted to see what happened.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really matter why. You know, you still have to deal with the broken window.
Okay. So how, when they're in trouble, how would a parent maybe want to address discussing that issue with their child?
Discussing in terms of...
A child's done something you're not happy with, how they did it. How would you address, instead of comparing them to their other child who would never do such a thing?
Well, I think that you begin to you start looking at what is the developmental level of the kid, you know, mm-hmm. the teenager. Do they really know mm-hmm. the difference?
Okay.
And then you start saying, okay, well, this behavior is not acceptable for whatever reason, and this is what's going to be the result of that. Mm-hmm. There's going to be either you're going to be grounded or you're going to be on restriction, or the video games are going to be pulled for a certain amount of time, or whatever the case. But you begin, there needs to be a reaction somewhat to whatever the behavior was.
So you're saying there always should be some consequences, some setting of limits for how children are responding, even as adolescents.
Absolutely.
The problem is, as I understand it, as I see it, is if the child has, by adolescence, has not begun to have a series of consequences set, some limits, it's very difficult to initiate those. For lots of reasons. One, you've got a dynamic setup that's been years in the making, and changing that can be fraught with problems and may be very resistant.
Well, you bring up a good point in that there are some families in which at heart I'm a family therapist, and there's a hierarchy in a family, and it's hardly that kind of depends on the age of the kid, but when the kids are basically ruling the roost here, when they are controlling things, when they are determining when consequences happen or what their consequences is, and the parents are feeling rather kind of out of it and helpless, it creates huge problems. And part of the work is to rebalance that system out. And it can be very difficult and lots of intensity going on, because the teenagers who are in control don't want to give up that power for obvious reasons. And so there's some things that we can do with parents to help them regain some of that power, not to be overly controlling, but to recognize when it is occurring, because we don't want to reinforce what is going wrong. The example I often use is when you are... I'll use dog training for an example. I think there's maybe not a lot of difference between dog training and parenting sometimes. If you have a dog jump up on you and you don't want the dog to jump up on you, and you grab them by the hand or by the paws and you look them in the eye and you tell their name, you tell them to get off, you have basically reinforced them jumping up on you. That's as opposed to...
Because you've recognized them, you've responded.
And, absolutely.
Right.
And I've responded to the things I don't want them to do.
Right.
As opposed to if they're sitting on the ground, then I reinforce them and say, good dog. So I'm reinforcing what I want, not reinforcing what I don't want. And I think that with families and teenagers, there are arguments that can occur. And it's... Oftentimes there are parents that are engaged in these circular arguments, and these things are going on and on and on. And what we're doing is essentially reinforcing that the kid has too much power.
It's fairly easy for me, having been a parent for a long time and dealing with parents, to see how parents can get trapped into this. And part of the reason is going back to temperament. If you've got a very, very strong, well, demanding, either the squeaky wheel gets the grease kind of child, then you're constantly asking yourself as a parent, am I right when I set the limit? If I set the limit that as a teenager you cannot go out and do this tonight, and the response from the intense kid is, well, you're the worst parent in the whole world. Everybody else's parents are letting them do this, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And you inevitably, unless you're very confident in your parenting, begin to ask yourself. And so even that can start very early in life by kids having a big temper tantrum and then getting rewarded because that quietens them down. So you get into this thing that gets started early in life and can be difficult.
It can be very difficult and very unsatisfying. Rather unhelpful.
And it doesn't have to always be the kid that's being the hard one. Sometimes parents come from a background where they feel like they need to be more rewarding and protective of a child over time, and they never learn to kind of that they have to have those limits set.
That's right.
All right. Well, let's take another one. Number 9. It says lecture, lecture, lecture.
Yeah. And the other part of that is note to your teen, a lecture begins after 15 seconds of talking.
Okay, you're right.
I see lecturing as desperation. As a parent, you know, we keep coming up with these logical reasons, and we're wanting for this whole litany of dialogue for our teenagers to say, oh, okay, I get it.
No,
it doesn't really happen. And by the way, they've turned off listening to you way back when. I mean, the lectures that will last for 5-10 minutes, it would be interesting to hear what the kids are really thinking about in that 5 to 10 minutes, mm-hmm. especially when they're not given a chance to respond.
Uh-huh.
So I think that the lecture, I think we need to keep the dialogue going, because lecturing is a one-way dialogue. Mm-hmm. It is a one-way thing, and that's not helpful.
Mm-hmm. So it gets back to try to opening the communication, hearing what they have to say.
And keeping the dialogue going, mm-hmm. even if it's uncomfortable things to hear.
Mm-hmm.
I'd much rather have a teenager talk about what is going on with them rather than them just internalizing it. Mm-hmm. And keeping it inside, because then when you internalize it, there's all sorts of misassumptions, misperceptions,
right.
and
right.
There's not a chance to kind of correct that.
Mm-hmm. And with the lecturing, you lose that opportunity to also kind of a little bit like what we talked about before and say, it's the behavior I'm upset about. I love you, separating behavior from your feelings about, because kids who are getting lectured all the time may easily jump to the conclusion you really don't care too much about.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's do one more here, and then we're getting a little bit close to break time. It says, use the words always underlined and or never underlined when commenting on your teenager's behavior. So
you're always doing this. You never do this. It is the extremes.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime you use the word always or never, there's going to be in a time when, well, I did clean my room that one time, or I did put the dishes away, or I did do well on my test or whatever. I mean, it's never absolute. And so when you start throwing out those absolute words, you kind of encourage, in a way, your teenager to begin to, in a sense, argue with you. Because
mm-hmm.
there's never just always or nevers.
Mm-hmm.
There's more grays out there than black and white.
So both this lecturing and this always nevers are really not encouraging. I'm trying to make some connection between all of this. Is it not encouraging this communication that's so important to understand where both people are coming from?
Yeah, you want to have a dialogue, and you want mm-hmm. to be able to hear what your teenager is thinking about, what they're feeling, not so much to make judgments about it, but to begin to understand where they're coming from, because we want to be able, in the end, to have the teenagers make their own decisions about things, and hopefully those decisions are more positive.
Yeah, and so often without that dialogue, we, as you've implied already, is you think you understand, but you can be very surprised when you hear their explanation that that had nothing to do with what you were thinking, and so you've lost that opportunity to.
It's a teaching moment.
Yeah,
it's a real teaching moment in which there's an understanding that can occur.
You're listening to Line One, your health connection. In Anchorage, you can call us at 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And our new email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a short break, let you guys ruminate a little bit over what we've talked about, try to encourage you to give us some calls and questions and maybe differences of opinion that we can discuss. And then we will continue talking with Richard Steinzig. You're listening to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today, my guest is Richard Steinzig, and we're talking about parenting adolescents. We've, up to this point, talked a lot about what parents' responsibilities are, what their job is, so to speak, and a little bit about the development of adolescents, how developments are thinking, what they're striving for, which is really to live and learn, or to live and develop and make their own decisions. But we've kind of commented on the fact that you really, as parents, we're trying to keep them from making some of these really bad decisions that can affect them the rest of their life, and yet at the same time balancing the need to struggle and fail every once in a while to really learn. If you've got questions or comments about what you hear today, our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Our telephone number, 550-8433. That's 550-8433. And our outside toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Please remember, if you're listening on Monday night between 7 and 8, you're listening to a recorded broadcast, and we won't be able to answer your questions or emails at that time. In addition, what we've been doing is kind of taking a list of mistakes or traps that parents make when dealing with adolescents and handle them one at a time, like Johnny Carson. It's not Johnny Carson. Who's the guy?
David Letterman.
Yes. Top 10. So we're working our way through those at the same time. We're going to take one more of those, and we are beginning to get a couple of phone calls, and we'll come back to those phone calls. Richard, the next one. On your list is predicting the kind of person your teenager will be in 10 years.
Yeah. It's hard to know what we're going to be like in you know, 10 minutes, 10 days. There is so much development and so much change and growth can occur in the time of adolescence. We just don't know, and especially between early adolescence and late adolescence. I mean, we know 13-year-olds think differently than 15-year-olds, which think differently than 17-year-olds. And oftentimes I'll have families in, and they're, for an example, there's a 14, 15-year-old teenager in the house, not doing well in school. They're very bright, but not doing their academics, kind of blowing things off, and the parents say, gee, you know, you're going to be, you're going to be a bum, you're not going to get a job, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I've been doing this long enough that I'm able to kind of see these kids. I see them 10 years later, lawyers, doctors, they have fabulous careers. You know, what they were going through in the middle of adolescence does not define who they are, what they're going to be. And I think it's a trap to kind of, as a parent, to say, you're going to be like this, because we just don't know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When you mention that, it's obvious that nobody can predict the future is one. But there's also sometimes it may be that we, I don't mean the parents necessarily, but I mean the environment, have not really understood this kid, adolescence, well. And that was written about a little bit in a book called The Myth of Laziness, in that the author, and I'm blocking on his name right now, he's a very famous developmental pediatrician, but he wrote the book, and basically his thesis was that sometimes or often there is no laziness. It's just we haven't found, or the child has not been introduced to something that really turns them on. We may not be challenging them enough in school. We may not be letting them do what really turns them on. We may not. We may be trying to make them do things they didn't want to do. So maybe the environment sometimes plays a role in that.
Sure. And Eric Erickson is. He talked about in adolescent development and human development, that sense of adolescence is they have that perspective of who am I and what am I going to do with it? And when those perspectives are balanced mm-hmm. out, they have a sense of identity. Mm-hmm. And I think we always need to understand that there's a continuum. I mean, there are some kids that are able to develop some of these skills that are necessary sooner and some later. there's the late bloomers.
Absolutely.
And I think that sometimes we kind of get into a rush to push kids, for example, that, mm-hmm. you know, they're just on the other end of the bell curve. Mm-hmm. But that's not a bad thing. That's just kind of who they are. And I think it's important for parents to understand that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good comment. Rick, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, I'm thankful that you've got the, I'll say, world-famous Rick Steinzig on as a counselor. He is one of the best in the city. We had been struggling with a son who had issues with fetal alcohol slightly and attachment disorder, and we brought him in, and he was the first one that said, well, you're the experts. What's worked? What hasn't? And where are we going to go from here? He really does put a good teamwork attitude together when he counsels, and I wish more counselors were like that.
Okay. Well, thanks for your comments.
That's very kind, Rick.
Richard was making sure he didn't promote this, but he very much appreciates your comments.
Well, his kid is slow in the swimming pool, but other than that, you know, pretty good counselor.
All right. Thanks.
Well, thanks.
Thanks for your call.
They get to the other end of the pool, and that's the important thing.
All right. Let's see if we can take another call real quick here. Judy, you're on line one.
Yes, I was going to talk to you about don't suffer the small stuff, which I'm sure that's what your social worker has said. My children are 3 years apart, and when our daughter was graduating from high school back in the late 90s, her older brother came to watch, and one of the mothers sidled up to me and said, how do you cope with that long hair on your son? And I said, well, maybe it's because he's on the dean's list and he ended up graduating Phi Beta Kappa on magna cum laude, and now he's got his hair shaved off. You right. don't suffer the small stuff.
Right. Yeah, I think about the parent who's trying to, you know, make decisions with toddlers again. I hate to keep making that analogy, but I think that way is the kid who wants to put on a yellow sock and a red sock to get out the door at 18 months to 20 years. So what? You know, getting them out the door is the important part.
Right. Yeah, the bite.
And actually, to this day, my son does walk leave the house with a yellow sock and a red sock.
Yeah, don't sweat the small stuff.
That's right. Thank you.
All right, Judy, thanks for your call. Here's an email, and I think a very good question. It says, we live in a society where our youth are participating in many things that are traditionally set aside for adulthood. In our culture, the transition from youth to adulthood is now very long, and this seems to not necessarily benefit our children. Life in our modern culture can be so easy with our children feeling a lack of purpose. How do you balance teaching your child social responsibility, individual responsibility, and still a strong work ethic without overscheduling them? Self-discipline is something I see a lack of in our youth and a grand sense of entitlement.
It's a good question. I think the over-scheduling of kids is a real problem. The goals that we're working toward in treatment and in certainly adolescent is sense of autonomy and independence. And when we are kind of scheduling these teenagers and that they have no free time to kind of develop who they are and what their interests are, I think that we are creating a situation where they certainly are dependent on the adults to kind of schedule that time for them. And, you know, I think there needs to be a middle ground someplace that, yeah, there's some things that we want to do, but we can't do it all. And by the way, I think it's okay for families to be able to spend time together without activities. Mm-hmm. It's a really tough question. You know, where's that balance? But I think we need to strive for that balance.
Why do you think some parents might do what we've described here as over scheduling? Is it a sense that they need to keep the child busy to stay out of trouble? Is it a sense that they need to do this because the neighbor is doing it? Is it a sense that this is what's going to make them happy? All of the above?
I think all of the above.
And if that's true, then is that correct?
Well, I think when we start looking about what is going to make the child happy, kids are operating under the pleasure principle. You know, what feels good, I want it now. I think that much of what we have to do as parents is, and this is what I see in my practice, is that we have to help these young folks deal with disappointment. We have to help them deal with obstacles that are in their way. And you don't get everything that you desired. I mean, that's not the way the world works. And I think that when, as a parent, we are doing all these things and buying all this stuff and creating the situations in which the teenager gets everything that they want, we certainly are contributing to that sense of entitlement. I want kids to understand that we have, you know, things don't always go that way. There's a struggle. There's an obstacle. How are we going to cope with that? Rather than, you know, just be angry or defiant to get my way.
So in this email that we've got, how do you balance teaching your child social responsibility, individual responsibility, and instill a strong work ethic without ever scheduling? Is you might at times let them make some of their own decisions, even though you think that's likely to be a bad decision, just to see what happens, help them understand. Or go ahead.
Well, I think there needs to be a conversation about it.
Uh-huh.
I think there needs to be a conversation about, number one, you know, what is the activity? What is the thing that the teenager wants to do? But then also, it's not always the parent's job to drop everything and provide the wheels, the money. I mean, I think that oftentimes, and certainly in my office, parents lose a track, and this is of the couple lose track of who they are. Especially as adolescents become older and a little bit more independent, it's a huge stress on the family because the parents have spent so much time on child rearing and focusing on the kid, and all of a sudden they lose the relationship of who they are as a couple. Divorce rates are 50% right now, very high, lots of blended families out there, and we want to be able to provide a situation for our teenagers to be able to deal with the obstacles that come their way.
Here's another email. This is one we kind of discussed briefly before we came on the air. It says, my children are 48 and 44. So this is my addition. They're not teens anymore. Did not benefit from the revelation I had when I heard that the butterfly does not have to struggle out of its cocoon. It is not able to fly. The research was designed to show that the results between struggle and no struggle on flight capabilities of butterflies. The butterflies that didn't have to struggle were able to crawl out of the cocoon and spread their wings enough to drive, but did not have the power to fly. The ones that had to struggle from the cocoon had the strength to fly. And then the writer says, the lights went off, and she writes the word teenagers in capitals. So struggle in the proper and appropriate levels, she says, gives us confidence to try. Being able to fail is often more important than to succeed. Now if we can just keep our kids healthy until their brain matures, about 25 or so, she says, we'll have the permanent liftoff. Your comments.
Well said.
Pretty well written. And, well and she knows her science because the brains are continuing, especially the frontal lobes, that area
right.
of the brain where executive function, where decisions are made. And so that it helps understand. Now we know why science, why kids can do some things that they don't think through the repercussions
well,
of.
Well, and the line that I was telling you before we got on the air, that the teenage brain is like a Ferrari, you know, sexy, shiny. Corners really fast, just has really lousy brakes. And that's that part of that frontal lobe, it's not developing. And it's kind of scary when kids kind of go off, for example, to go off to college for the first time. And do they have the ability to kind of manage their behavior, have some control, focus? College is an expensive mistake.
Yeah, and they have to have some experience before they get there to learn how to judge and make decisions on things like that.
Absolutely.
That's what she's saying is that kind of what we've talked about earlier. It's okay to try and fail a couple of times. In fact, you learn a lot more, as she says, or somebody has said recently, that's really one of the better ways to learn.
Yeah, as long as it's the failure is not too big.
Yeah, and that something I wrote down here is along that same line, which is I think what bothers all of us as parents is, can parents do everything right, everything correctly, and still have a teen who has made a mistake with significant life consequences?
Yes.
Yeah, that's exactly what I... So it's not necessarily also a reflection on parents if kids make a bad mistake.
No.
It's immaturity. It's not having been there. Sometimes.
Yeah. There's a lot of outside pressures.
Mm-hmm.
There are the peer pressures. There's the school pressures. There's the social media stuff.
Mm-hmm. And adults make mistakes.
adults
so
make
why should we hold our kids to a higher standard?
Exactly.
Right.
And I guess the biggest piece is when there is a mistake, what has our children learned from it?
Right.
You know, and I think that's where, as a parent, we can kind of help talk and help them process where that is in terms of what did they learn from this other than I just got in trouble.
Okay, you're listening to Line One. My guest is Richard Steinzig. We're talking about talking with parents, talking with adolescents. Excuse my slip up there. If you've got questions or comments about what you hear today, our local number is 550-8433. 550-8433. Toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. So let's continue on our top 10 parenting traps. Number 6, start a question with, how many times?
Yeah. Another sense of desperation. We all do that. It's a kind of a symbol of how frustrated we are. And when we start off a question like that, what are our kids hearing? Because my guess is they're turning off. As soon as they hear the how many times, they're probably turning off that, what's coming next.
Here's, I'm going to move on to another one. Number 5, using the difficult and complicating time of adolescence to ask them, what's the matter with you?
This is where I think it's important to understand what's the developmental things going on with teenagers? There's a lot of changes happening physically, emotionally, cognitively. And, the teenage mind is basically a remodeling zone.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be very confusing. And sometimes some kids handle it more gracefully than others. But when we do the what's the matter with you, we're kind of blaming, we're shaming. It is not creating a situation where there's a dialogue going back and forth.
All right, let's take another caller. Linda, you're on line one.
Hi, good afternoon. I just had a quick comment. I have to agree that the teenage brain, the teenage person, is a work in process. And my baby just turned 21, so we have survived several teenagers. And one of the things that my husband and I did is we'd take long walks in the evening, and we'd pretend like our children weren't ours, that we were babysitting. And that provided that emotional detachment. But it really did help during those moments of, wanting to drop kick them across the universe. So
tell me how that worked. This is a new one on me. You'd think, God, I've been in practice 30 years, I'm 60 years, I thought I've heard it all. Tell me how that works.
Oh, you mean pretending like they're not yours?
Yeah.
Yeah. Going for a walk and then coming back and having to deal with something. You know how if you're taking care of somebody else's house or taking care of somebody else's pet, you're very conscientious about making sure that their needs are met and you're being kind and you want to do the very best thing possible. And
I gotcha.
sometimes when you're, you know, with your own children, you have so much at stake that you have an emotional reaction that maybe won't be the best thing. So that's just a little bit of emotional detachment, even though you're powerfully and madly in love with your kids and you want to do the right thing.
Well, and it's also the balance of taking some time with your spouse, too. And being together with them, and that you have a life other than only your children.
Yes, and that's true. Yeah, and I think, you know, and my other comment is about modeling behavior.
Oh yeah.
We're believers in the process is more important than the product, and so having stuff is great as long as you enjoy the process of getting it, whether that stuff is a college degree or. For my son, it was an Xbox and Halo and all those sorts of things. But anyway, thank you so much. I've really been enjoying this conversation.
Well, thanks for your comments.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
I think a lot of enlightened parents are concerned about the Halo and the Xbox, as Linda just commented. I guess I'd comment that, and Richard, I'll need your comments as well. The Academy of Pediatrics, doesn't come down that says you can't do that or you shouldn't do that. It's the quality amount of time and how much it's taking you away from other things. So, I would, you know, again, I'm asking Richard's comments. This is an important one. We certainly have these distractions, but they should be limited, and what you do on them and what kinds of products you have are what is important. Richard, your comment.
Yeah, I think that these things are all over. They're here to stay. I think it's about kind of setting some parameters around that.
Right.
And I think it also goes back to temperament, too. If you have a child that has a temperament which is they have problems with focus, and or maybe they're more reactive to stress and things like that. And you put them in front of a TV or a video game, they're going to get sucked in, and they kind of lose perspective on everything else. You know, not every teenager that plays Halo or video game can play it for 7 hours straight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some will say, you know, after 30 minutes or an hour, okay, I've had enough and I'm going to do something else. There are others that, boy, they are just locked in. And, you know, what I work with my parents on and they're in my office is how can we begin to set some limits on that? And that's in that sense of balancing the hierarchy. You know, who decides that he gets to spend 7 hours on a video game? You know, and what happens when the parents say, okay, you have a limit of an hour or 2 hours? And what is the pattern of those interactions? And that's it's real important stuff.
We're into our last 5 minutes. We got four more of the top 10, and I'm going to skip over the next two. I'll mention them. Only focus on the small stuff and ignoring the larger, more important. We've kind of touched on that already. And number three, keeping a mental scorecard of past behaviors and constantly rehashing past problems. Hopefully those who have been listening understand that one. But number two, setting unrealistic goals and consequences. Seems to me a little different issue.
Yeah, I think that as when I have parents that come in and they say, I want my child to be a hockey player. I want my child not only to be a hockey player, but I want my child to be the best hockey player. Or I want my child to get straight A's. That's the only thing that is acceptable to me. Or I want my child never to use drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's setting the bar pretty high.
Mm-hmm.
And I often have to work with my families and my parents, and it's like I don't disagree with those goals, but boy, we're setting ourselves up for failure, because what happens when one of those things happen?
Mm-hmm.
And so I really try to help our parents, you know, what's realistic? And sometimes it's a personal journey to figure out what is realistic. and some of it comes from their own experiences, and we kind of have to talk about that.
From a sports standpoint, you can only control those things, your preparation. You can't control the other people. You can't control the weather. So, you know, I'm thinking of a straight A. Sometimes you just get a good class with a bunch of really smart people or a very, very demanding teacher. And, you know, so you're not going to win all the episodes.
No. And there are some kids that are very gifted that are able to do the academic things very well. There's some other kids that really have to work hard at that process. I would much rather have an I want my kids to learn rather than to get the A.
Learn how to learn.
Yeah. You know, it's like
enjoy learning.
Enjoy learning. I mean, yeah, you can get the A by doing extra credit or that stuff, but are they actually learning the material?
Right. That's a good point. Yeah. All right, last one, last couple of minutes. Use guilt and shame to create motivation.
Yeah, this was a initially I had this as this was the Jewish mother technique as a homage to my my mother. But as I was kind of sharing this with folks, lots of people tend to use this, not just the Jewish mothers. Guilt and shame is, I think, one of those. A couple of those aspects that can be very, very disheartening for a kid to hear. It's all about the parents and about how you are being perceived, and you should do this to make me feel better. And I think it's really backwards. You know, we really have to help our kids have some of that intrinsic motivation, not just to please the parent, but to please themselves. And so creating some of that intrinsic motivation is very hard. Mm-hmm. But the guilt and shame, I just don't see working very well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Rewarding the effort, kind of getting back a little bit the same, is more likely to be successful than really getting upset and
That's
blaming
right.
them.
That's right.
It just seems to work, and the evidence, there's plenty of evidence that suggests that.
Lots of studies that, mm-hmm. that say that that's not.
But that's not the way all of us necessarily were parenting, and we have a tendency to parent the same way.
Well, and, you know, and unfortunately, on some of these parenting traps, you know, I kind of do some of these too. I know that I was raised with a lot of kind of guilt and shame coming from my family, and sometimes it kind of comes out of my mouth, and my family will basically call me on it. It's easy to do what we've been taught from mm-hmm. early on. So we want to be able to minimize these things as much as possible. It's not going to be 100%.
Well, we're at the end of the program. My thanks to you. This has been, you know, we've done a number of different parenting programs or things revolved around parenting, but this was very succinct and very, very useful. Thanks for your time.
Good to be here.
Next week, we're going to be back, as you can guess, July 18th, about 2 p.m. My guest will be Anchorage dermatologist Dr. Peter Ernstrom at that time. We're going to be discussing skin cancer, and in particular, we'll be talking about melanoma. There's issues about, are we getting enough vitamin D from sunlight? And dermatologists are saying, hey, you know, that sunlight stuff's not so good. So we really want to get to the bottom of issues like that. What's the cause of melanoma? What we can do to prevent it? And then what's new in treatment? And we'll talk about other skin cancers as well. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program and answered our phones for us. Thanks for listening, and especially to those who took the time to call or email. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line One, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.